are going to our Father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man, yeah, to see the unification of all Africans. Proving to our Father's land. Yeah. How good and how pleasant it would be before God and man to see the unification of all Rasta man. Yeah. As it's been said already, let it be done. We are the children of the higher man. So, Africa, unite. Africa, unite. Yeah. Unite for the benefit of your people. Unite for it's greater than anything. Unite for the benefit of your children. Unite for it's greater than anything.
Welcome to Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we have an excellent show lined up for you today. We have a guest with us on today, a comrade who is a member of an organization based in California that is a Mexican National Liberation Organization. And we're going to have some discussion on some of the things that are going on in Mexico right now. So I'm going to go ahead and bring him on the air. Comrade Ricardo Favela from MUDP, Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo. Uhuru, comrade. Uhuru, comrade. Can you hear me? Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru.
How's it going?
Good, good.
Great. Okay, so just wanted to have some discussion with you today on you know, some of the things that are going on out there in Mexico. We see all around the world, there's really a serious resistance that's going on, and we wanted to discuss with you, you know, some of the things that are going on in Mexico. But before we get into that, could you introduce to the listeners who may not know of your organization, of who you are and who your organization is?
Okay. We're Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo, which basically means Mexicans United in Defense of the People. And it's basically an organization that was founded in 1993 in response to... specifically to a police beating one of the youth here who was organizing the Mexican community in its own defense and whatnot. Prior to this beating, our community was living under a very repressive environment. I mean, still is, but even more so due to the fact that the Ku Klux Klan was based in this community. It's in the northern part of San Diego. It's in a very rural area. One of the main crops that's produced here is avocados and the lemons and oranges and nurseries. And the Ku Klux Klan decided to base their home here in this town. And just like the typical relationship that white people have with all colonial peoples, they can't live without us. So, you know, this is where we come in to pick all the food and basically be the backbone of the economy for this community. So, so we were living in this type of environment where the Tom Metzger and the KKK operated openly and freely and whatnot. And as youth, we began to stand up to this type of outright repression and racism. And we learned, you know, from other people from the Chicano movement of the past. We learned from the Black Panthers, you know, and the stances they took. And eventually we even came in contact with the African People's Socialist Party and were, you know, again, learned from the work and that the party was doing. And we felt that it was time for us to stand up and organize ourselves. And this is when one of our compañeros was beaten at his home by the sheriffs. And for the first time, the Mexican community here stood up and marched through the main street here and, you know, demanded that, first of all, denouncing the beating, and second of all, demanding his release since he was jailed, which was done so within a matter of 24 hours. And from then on, this organization has been struggling, specifically in the North County of San Diego, dealing with police brutality, dealing with issues of housing, dealing with, you know, organizing the youth and whatnot. And we've begun to also work in Los Angeles, and we're doing, our work is beginning to open up in the North County, you know, Fallbrook, in the city of Vista. There's been a lot of work happening there, and we're beginning to also try to hook up with the international struggles as well.
Right on, right on. I wanted to ask just if we can get into some of what's going on. We see in the news a lot about this rebellion that's happening in Oaxaca. Could you explain to folk out there what's going on out there?
Okay, from what I understand, a certain sector of the teachers' unions in Mexico, and specifically in the state of Oaxaca, have been for the past few years. I don't know how many years it's been now, but for the past few years, they've been basically demanding for more resources to be put into the more rural schools in the indigenous communities of Oaxaca. Oaxaca is, first of all, is a state that's one of the most impoverished states in the country. Of Mexico, next to Chiapas, next to Guerrero, and Oaxaca, and it's also a state where probably the largest community of indigenous people are found in Mexico. A rich culture of what's known as Mixtecos, Zapotecos, Mijes, different variety of indigenous communities that still speak their indigenous language. Many communities there don't even speak Spanish. I mean, so even the effects of the colonization haven't been, you know, culturally been too effective. But for this reason, these communities have been very marginalized, and specifically in education aspect, these teachers, since it basically the way it works is if your union goes along with the ruling class, which in Oaxaca has been the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, which was the party that has been in power in Mexico since the 1910 revolution, and it's notorious for its corruption and whatnot. So if you're not aligned with this party, basically you're left out of the dinner table, you know what I'm saying? So this sector of teachers have been some of the more principled teachers in the area since they work mainly with the community of, you know, indigenous peoples. And for the past few years, they've been demanding more resources, more pay for the teachers, more resources for their schools. Because in certain situations, I mean, the rooftops are for their school classes are you know, I mean, they're literally teaching out in, you know, in the same, under the same conditions that the people live in. So even the school buildings are, you know, covered with plastic for roofs and whatnot. So basically this year, they basically said, you know, this is enough. You know, the government hasn't been paying attention to their concerns. And they've decided to call a strike, which was about 5 months ago, and basically take on the governor, you know, the person that represents, you know, the corruption of the party, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, which is Ulises Ruiz, and basically saying, since you're not, you know, since you're not listening to us, we're demanding your, you know, resignation. You know, he's known for being one of the more, you know, more corrupt, openly corrupt politicians in Mexico, and from this call, basically the community has united with the call of the teachers. They've, you know, just for the same conditions of impoverishment, the people have joined up with this movement, and they've it's gone from being a teacher strike to basically a people's movement, since they've opened it up. Well, they've opened up the struggle under what's called the APO, the Association of the Popular Association of the Peoples of Oaxaca, and it's been a movement that's been very interesting, very dynamic, and it's basically, you know, calling for the resignation, and at this point, if, you know, they're saying that if Ulises doesn't resign, you know, we're basically calling for an autonomous government. You know what I'm saying? Autonomous, autonomy, basically autonomy.
I was reading about this, and I understand that the governor Ruiz had also. I mean, you talk about the corruption and stuff. I also read that he was, you know, had been involved in like some assassinations of some political organizers leading up to this thing and whatnot. You know, can you say something about, you know, about this guy Ruiz?
I mean, it's just the typical way this, you know, the leadership of this party works in order to maintain some type of power.
Yeah.
They'll, to the point of political assassinations or whatnot. I mean, the opposition, anyone who really stands up to oppose their stance, you know, and anybody poses a real threat. I don't know too much of the details as to certain cases. I know it's been mentioned that some of the people he works with have been the same people that assassinated a potential presidential candidate. I think it was in 94, I believe so. So I mean, it's the same ruling mafia that, you know, I mean, they have the strategy of maintaining power, and political assassinations is just one, you know, the more extreme tactic that they use.
Yeah. Now, recently they sent in like federal troops, right, into Oaxaca.
Right.
How was that affect the stuff on the ground? I know. I saw some footage. You had sent me actually some footage. On some of the confrontations there. But has the because it's like, how many troops was it that they sent?
I can't give you the number. I'm not sure. It was I'm not sure.
Okay. But has that had an effect? I mean, has that been able to has that stopped in any way, you know, like the resistance there?
No, it has not stopped the resistance at all. No. Right. And that was basically the illegitimate president's response. You know, I'm talking about Vicente Fox. That was his response to dealing with this issue. See, the thing with the Apo is that they've declared themselves to be a nonviolent movement, right? And it's basically as a strategy to get more people involved and to openly resist and denounce this corrupt governor and whatnot. So what's happened is, basically the people have joined this struggle. There's the APO within itself as an organization that's functioning, but I mean there's people that just go out and operate on their own and participate in the struggles in their own way and they organize themselves. And so they sent in the what's known as the PFP, the Federal Preventative Police. You know, in Spanish it's Policía Federal Preventivo, and basically what this is supposed to be these police federal troops, like a National Guard type of thing, that are trained in repressing movements, and they've occupied the downtown area of Oaxaca. But I mean, since there's so much popular support, I mean, they only found themselves surrounded. You know what I'm saying? So for them, I mean, they can go in and occupy the little downtown plaza, but the rest of the what's the county and the surrounding cities are, you know, in the are basically in the hands of the people. So it's ineffective for them to go and occupy, you know, maybe just the business sector of the area. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I was reading some, because I mean this is an exciting type of thing to see happening, you know, because I was reading some stuff about the state had attacked and destroyed like radio capacity of the organization, and then the people seized more radio stations and television stations too.
What was that again? Can you?
I was reading that the state had, when the troops had like destroyed the capacity, like the media capacity of the organization, that the people seized, you know, other media capacity, other radio stations and television stations, what I was reading, it was like a toe-to-toe thing. The state comes and destroys something, the people take some more.
Right, yeah. At one point, I believe they had, the people had control over 10, I think it was radio stations, and I think a couple TV stations and whatnot. And the state, or yeah, the federal police have taken back quite a few of them, but one of the major ones that they haven't been able to take over has been the Radio Universidad, which the university radio, which the university there in Oaxaca is also, you know, the universities are supposed to be autonomous universities and whatnot. And the people basically have set up barricades, and there was a confrontation when the federal police tried to take over this radio station, and they were ineffective. Other people were effectively kept them out, and they do have control of this one major radio station where they broadcast 24 hours a day and give direction to the movement and whatnot. So yeah, so there has been that element of radio stations and whatnot. Yeah.
Okay, right on. I want to offer the opportunity for our listeners out there to be able to participate in this discussion. You can call in here. If you're calling within the U.S., you can call toll-free at 1-877-824-3337. And if you're calling from outside of the U.S., it's not toll-free, but you can call country code 001-727-824-5700. And you can also participate by emailing us. You can do so by clicking the email DJ button on the right side of yahooradio.com website, or you can email us directly at dj@yahooradio.com. We're speaking with Comrade Ricardo Favela from Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo. And we will be right back with more discussion on the situation in Mexico and Oaxaca and throughout the rest of Mexico.
Instead of D-O-E, damn it. yet United Clan. Stole the land, same way you confiscated Africans. Gold diamonds, whole tan, rubber loaded rubber vans. Ain't no sense in stuttering.
To Salmon, CeeLo's, MSP Productions.
African People Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela's new book, One Africa, One Nation, is available now. In this historic collection, the chairman and representatives of the Emerging African Socialist International explain why Africa and all its resources must be liberated and in the hands of African workers and peasants in Africa and everywhere. The chairman's new book, One Africa, One Nation, documents the process of building the African Socialist International, which is rapidly growing in countries throughout Africa and in the US, the Caribbean, and elsewhere around the world. For pictures of the chairman's recent book signing tour, and to order your copy of One Africa, One Nation, go to burningspearuhuru.com. That's www.burningspearuhuru.com.
I'm Sibusiso Xaba, president of PICO of Azania. I keep my ear on Uhuru Radio, the voice of the International African Revolution. One Africa, one nation.
welcome back to Africa Live on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we have been speaking so far with comrade Ricardo Favela from Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo about the situation going on in Oaxaca, Mexico. Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru.
So we were discussing before just, you know, generally, you know, what's going on in Oaxaca. I wanted to ask, are there any, in watching this thing, I've wondered, you know, were there any revolutionary organizations involved in what's going on there?
Oh, definitely. There are definitely various type of organizations involved, particularly the EZLN, the mass organization that was launched, I believe last year, which is known as the Other Campaign. They're involved in this. I mean, there's Marxist-Leninist groups, you know, anarchist groups, whatnot. There are definitely organizations that are working above ground, and there's even a presence, specifically in Oaxaca. There's been a presence of groups such as the Ejército Popular Revolucionario, which is the Revolutionary People's Army, that have been operating in Oaxaca for quite a few years. And, you know, there are definitely, you know, people working in various ways with this. And, you know, at the same time, there's the presence of the people themselves that have been, you know, at the forefront. Yeah.
Okay. And the EZLN, which more people may know as the Zapatistas. Could you explain who they are and the role that they play in this thing?
What's been happening for the past year now is that the EZLN has launched what's known as the Other Campaign, and this was somewhat in response to the presidential election that took place this past year. And what they were basically saying was that they're launching a mass campaign for people to get involved in. That would be an alternative to getting involved in the electoral struggle, and basically beginning to lay out a national plan of struggle for the people. You know, it's basically the way of getting out of the containment that they've been in for the past few years in Chiapas, and you know, and put out a national plan of struggle. So what they have been doing, specifically Subcomandante Marcos, has been traveling throughout the country, visiting with various communities, and putting together this plan of struggle. Around the same time that the struggle in Oaxaca came out on the scene, the Otra Campaña and Marcos had been in Oaxaca, and what's interesting about this Other Campaign is that it's opening this space where, or it's providing the space where various groups can come together and work together and deal with specific questions on a very broad, on a very open level. And it's been a catalyst for uniting the different struggles happening all around the country and whatnot. So to what degree that itself led to what happened in Oaxaca, I'm not sure exactly. I can't really call that. But what happens is once these struggles unfold, once certain situations pop off like what's happening in Oaxaca, the EZLN will send one of their own comandantes from the Clandestine Revolutionary Indigenous Committee, which is the leadership of the EZLN, to these communities to begin to organize with the people. So there are comandantes in Oaxaca that are involved in the organizing, the strategizing, and all that of this movement. So that would be basically how the EZLN is involved at this point.
Okay. Now, another thing is, I mean, we talk about the stuff going on in Oaxaca, But it's not just Oaxaca where resistance is happening. I understand there's also some stuff happening in Atenco. Could you inform listeners about what's going on there?
Right, right. Yeah, definitely. Atenco was a situation that came out just within a few months of what happened in Oaxaca. And Atenco has a history of struggle as well prior to this year. I believe it was, I think it might have been a couple years ago, where the government wanted to put an airport in this community and basically move this community of indigenous people, you know, just move them out of the way for this airport. And the people said, no, man, you know, this is our land. We're not going to let you, you know, take our land. And you know, they people came out with machetes in hand and, you know, ready to take on the federal police for them to remove them. And the government had to back down. So that was a couple years ago. So what happened earlier this year, and the same Otra Campaña has been involved with the struggle in Atenco specifically. And as a matter of fact, Marcos was in Atenco for one of the planning meetings, and within a week or two after he left to continue on with the tour, is when the struggle popped off in Atenco, and that was basically around the issue of people being able to sell their own products in the open out, you know, just how it's been traditionally. Walmart, there was plans for a Walmart to be built in this community, and they had because of this Walmart, you know, they had basically taken away the right of the people there to sell their own products, to sell their own flowers. And, you know, which is, you know, what some people subsist off of. And so the people said, you know, we're going to still sell our flowers. They went out there, and the police were sent in to shut them down. And the police that were sent in were basically taken hostage and beaten by the people, being pretty severely. And in response to this, again, the more federal police were sent in to occupy this community, and basically, you know, to repress this community, and it was real ugly, man. I mean, they just arrested all kinds of people, men and women. Quite a few of the women that were arrested were sexually assaulted. They were raped while in prison. Some of the people that were involved in this have been disappeared, and due to the struggle that burst out in the open, Marcos and the EZLN had to pause their national tour, and they returned back to Atenco to organize to get the compañeros out of jail and to expose the government and their role in this repression and whatnot. So, that was just just within a few months before the what happened in Oaxaca. Yeah.
So, what's the current status on things going on in Atenco?
Well, there are a certain amount of people have been released, but there are also people that have been disappeared and they haven't been accounted for. I can't give you the exact, figures of how many people are and whatnot, but there is a struggle to demanding to release the political prisoners that have been involved in this, and from what the people are saying, I mean, they're ready to resist. They're ready to continue struggling against what's characterized as neoliberalism, which is basically the, allowing Walmarts to come into communities and take away the jobs of the people there. I mean, they're ready to resist these type of corporations that are coming in and, destroying the community. Yeah.
Right on. You had started to discuss the Otra Campaña, the other campaign. Could you say more about that and whether your organization has any relationship to the other campaign?
Okay, so going back to the Otra Campaña, there's a specific document that was put out by the EZLN announcing this Otra Campaña, and it's basically known as the sixth declaration of the Lacandonian jungle. It's the sixth communique document that the EZLN has put out over their past since they've been out in the open since 1994, and it's a plan to open up the struggle to an anti-capitalist struggle to all the peoples of Mexico, and at this point it's characterized as a nonviolent movement. You know, and it's to bring in the various forces and to have the different organizations begin to organize and strategize and deal with specific issues and whatnot. But this one declaration, I really recommend if people want to know more about it to look for the sixth declaration of the Lacandonian Jungle. It's in English, it's in Spanish. You can find it on the net. But right now, they've just concluded phase one of the other campaign, and again, it was also launched around the time that the presidential elections were taking hold in Mexico, and it was basically it's basically beginning to sharpen the contradictions in Mexico, and we feel it's basically looking like it's going to be the final offensive in Mexico, and for this what I'm saying by that is. First of all, dealing with the elections, they declared, this campaign is saying, you know what, we don't believe in the electoral system. In fact, we don't believe in the whole system. Right. The system is irredeemable. And so, that's not a route that we think is going to solve anything, you know what I'm saying? So, because there are certain questions. Is Marcos going to run for president since now he's out in the open or what? Does this mean they're going to be a political party? No, it's a campaign to... get, geared towards the workers, men and women, whatnot, all oppressed sectors of Mexican society into one national campaign, into one national struggle that's aiming at, toppling the neocolonial government. And so basically what, they've just finished phase one of this campaign, which has been the tour of Comandante Marcos, Subcomandante Marcos, to the various communities, having a dialogue with the peoples, with the different, indigenous peoples that are dealing with their issues, and the tour has gone to all pretty much corners of Mexico. And it's opened up even to pretty much Mexican people everywhere. It was opened up to Mexican people over here on this side of the illegitimate border. And it's very profound in that sense that we've been able to get in touch with other communities that are in struggle and begin to network within each other, with each other. And so this phase one has been to go out and create this dialogue with the communities and make an assessment of the situations in various communities and furthermore make a national plan of struggle, to begin to launch movements and whatnot. So this phase has been, is concluding, and the second phase, again, is to put forth a new constitution for people to fight for, basically. So we united with this call that was made by the EZLN, the other campaign, and we have sent a few, delegations out to some of the plenaries out in Mexico City. We've been involved with this process. We've been proposing the question of the problems that Mexican people face over here on this side of the border, dealing with the question of occupied land, occupied territory, the question of the fact that we're one Mexican people, that it's an illegitimate border that does nothing to divide us as a people, that our struggle is one. Within this other campaign, it's a campaign for the liberation of Mexican people. then, but you know, some people might ask, what about white people? What about other people? And there is the white left is very present in Mexico, and whatnot. And so, as a part of this, they have created some type of what you would call, you know, what the Huru movement has done as far as the solidarity movement, and it's known as the Intergalactica, right? The intergalactic is for basically for all other peoples, all other non-Mexican peoples who are in support of the struggle for them to hook up with that. So that's been opened up.
Okay. That sounds like some interesting stuff. Is the other campaign, is it dealing at all with in terms of, because it seems like it's taking on some democratic struggles, is it dealing at all with the whole question of immigration, you know, and you know, across this illegitimate border?
There has positions are being proposed. To that degree, there hasn't been so much a position to deal with that question. A lot of the questions are dealing with the struggles in Mexico at this point that are taking, I guess, a priority over most issues. But within each, I guess, other campaign organization in every regional area, you know, there's also, you know, the responsibility of each community to deal with the specific questions that they're dealing with. So there hasn't been an overall position or you know, a plan to deal with, you know, that specific question. It's been more about just dealing with, you know, Mexico and whatever each community is dealing with on a local level. Yeah.
Okay. We are speaking with Comrade Ricardo Favela from Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo, MUDP. We invite those of you out there who are listening in to participate in this discussion. You can call in at 1-877-824-3337. That's for if you're calling from within the U.S., that's a toll-free number at 1-877-824-3337. If you're calling from outside of the U.S., you can also participate in this discussion. It's not toll-free, but you can call us at 001-727-824-5700. Again, that's country code 001-727-824-5700. And you can also feel free to contact us through email. You can click email DJ on the right side of your WhoRadio.com website. Or you can email us directly at DJ@WhoRadio.com. So I want to ask you, comrade, just about the... in terms of your organization, MUDP... what kind of organizing are you all involved in at this moment on the ground?
Well, quite a few things. On a local level, we've been dealing with the issue of police shootings in a particular community in Vista, and also the question of the Minutemen, which has been, you know, a group of white people that are, you know, trying to make life miserable for Mexican workers and whatnot. In the city of Vista, which is right next door to the city where, you know, we've been organizing, which is Fallbrook. It's a larger community of, you know, it's a large community. There's somewhere like 90,000 people, and half of the residents there are Mexican. And last year there were three shootings that happened within a period of 5 days. All the people the three people that were killed were Mexican males. All three were unarmed, you know, and so this basically created some concern in this particular community because there was a shooting a year before, I think about 2 years before that, another shooting in which. A Mexican male was, you know, he needed psychological help. He was, suicidal and whatnot, and the police showed up and basically shot him, something around 20 times. When that happened, the community did a march. They marched down to the police station. Some of the forces there that, you know, in Vista that, you know, were more in touch with the community, tried to organize the people there, but nothing really came from it. You know, it kind of just got swept under the rug. So when this camp happened, it was pretty apparent that there was no voice for the community in Vista. There was no one really able to take some type of stance against these shootings, against the police, you know, and their policies and all that. So we began to participate in, and we made a call for a coalition to be formed of the various groups, of various forces that work in this community, and basically beginning to watch how the investigations proceed forth, communicating any information that we find to the community, and even making certain demands to the community in regards to the police in their policies. One of the things that that the police themselves said that, they can't do anything about these cops that shot these people because they have a clean record, you know what I'm saying? They've never had a complaint before. So we decided to form a human rights committee that would be a committee that would document any type of abuses and whatnot, and begin to show the community, basically to have a committee there that would be accessible to the community in terms of documentation of abuses and whatnot, to begin to, have some type of organized opposition, to what's happening there. Along with that, when this started happening, the Minutemen started showing up at a particular intersection where day laborers look for work every morning. It's in, pretty much in the center of the city, and for white people, it's an eyesore to see, Mexicans looking for work. So these Minutemen, and most of them, the majority of them don't even live in this community. They came from, either surrounding cities or even as far away as like an hour away from a place called Orange County, which is known for the reactionary backwardness over there, So they started showing up at this intersection trying to discourage people from employing these workers, and harassing the workers themselves, And they try to give this image of being patriots and whatnot, And the pathetic thing is a lot of people are buying into it. I mean, it's just white nationalism. It's just open white nationalism, that the city is allowing for this group to come in and do what they do. So basically, the situation in this community was just getting more hostile, because of the sheriffs, because of, these white people and stuff. At the same time is when the resistance movement came out in opposition to the H.R. 4437 initiative, which is basically a white people's attempt to launch an organized genocide of Mexican people, so all this started happening in this particular city, and when the May 1st boycott and strike was called for, we organized the what we call a resistance center, or a refuge center for people that want to participate in this national strike. That we could gather in this one park where we're going to have a program for the day, we wanted to do something besides just going out and marching, Because at that point, man, that movement that popped off it affected every Mexican community, You had the national marches in Chicago and L.A., which in L.A. they say it was close to 2 million people that marched. And I know the media was saying that it was roughly over 500,000, but it was confirmed that it was easily over 1 million, and so there were some reports that it was close to 2 million people that marched in Los Angeles. And then following the weekends after that, the students, you know, started walking out of the high schools in record numbers as well. In Fallbrook right here alone, the students walked out for you know, three consistent days, and they wanted to basically not even go back to school. They wanted to continue organizing, man, and you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, there was just a tremendous amount of, you know, of resistance and a high spirit of struggle. But along with that, you know, in certain communities, in Vista and these other, in certain other communities like Escondido and Oceanside, the police started coming down on the youth because, you know, there weren't any organizers there to help them out. You know what I'm saying? I mean, specifically here in Fallbrook, I mean, we were out there with the youth all, you know, throughout the whole time, basically, making sure everything was organized, making sure the police don't, you know, mess with them and whatnot. But other communities didn't, you know, they didn't have people organizing them. So basically it was the youth going out and, the you know, dealing, you know, confronting the police, you know, directly, you know what I'm saying? And in certain cases it was repression. In Oceanside, the police started shooting at the kids with rubber bullets and whatnot. And so there was already this type of, you know, and especially in Vista, I mean, just this only deepens the situation that's been happening there. So on May 1st, we had this demonstration, and estimates were that there were over 2,000 people that came out and participated in the strike. And what's interesting was that the petty bourgeoisie was denouncing the strike. They were telling people not to go out and strike. They're telling them to stay in school and whatnot. There was a very visible line that happened between the initial marches that first came out, you know, which were in Chicago and L.A., to the next call that was made for a strike. You know, it was basically the working class who said, you know what, we're going to go on strike. Forget you guys, you know, the petty bourgeoisie. Forget the churches. Forget all you guys that said, you know, are telling us not to do this. We're going to go on and do this, you know what I mean? So we had roughly about 2,000 people out there, and it was a very organized demonstration. I mean, nothing. I mean, very smooth. I mean, no problems, you know, internally, and that's saying a lot because we brought together people from different communities, youth from different communities that have the tendency. There's a question of, you know, gangs and whatnot. You know what I'm saying? Most, you know, two particular communities that would never be in the same area without, you know, some type of confrontation were there, you know, united in the struggle. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And we were able to keep this thing organized. And on top of that, you know, we had the program for the day where we were calling up different cities, different contacts that we had throughout the country, and even Mexico City, we were able to communicate with the radio station in Venezuela to report on the day's events. And so we had these solidarity statements coming through, you know, the sound system. We called the APSP. You know, we got solidarity statements from the APSP in Oakland, the APSP in St. Petersburg, the Solidarity Committee. So it was a program in which, you know, the people were, you know, pretty much united, you know, hooked up with the other struggles and receiving a very different message, you know what I'm saying? And so it was real good in that aspect. And when the day was ending, at the end of the day, you know, it was afternoon, everybody took off. There was pretty much a good group of people that wanted to continue, you know, with the struggle, you know what I'm saying? And they went out and started marching through town. And again, since, they were out there on their own, and the police went out and tried to, deal with these youth, you know, the police being who they are, you know, began to repress the community, and the youth started to stand up to them. You know, it got to the point where rocks and bottles were being thrown at the police. They pretty much kept them out of a certain community, you know, which is one of the major Mexican barrios sections of the community. They were able to keep them out for a while, and you know, we came home, and then we got word of this later on at night that there was a riot going on in Vista. And so we went out there to observe what was happening, and the police, the sheriffs and all that, they were basically at a major intersection trying to gear up to come in and retake this particular community, you know what I'm saying, because they couldn't go in there without rocks and bottles being thrown at them, you know what I'm saying? And So they called for backup from the various cities. They called even called for a contingency of the National Guard to come in. It was something like over like 30 squad cars, all packed with pigs. You know what I'm saying? You know, and at a certain point, they went in slowly to take back supposedly this community. And what's funny is, I mean, the youth, I mean, even when they were coming into the community, the youth were sitting there taunting them, you know. You know, they had their Mexican flags, like, you know, I mean, just like a very high spirit of resistance, man, was there. And, you know, and certain people began to denounce what was happening out here in Vista, like, well, you know, everybody else behaved. What about what happened to you guys, you know what I'm saying? What we're saying is that, you know, that this is, you know, this is what's underneath. It's a very thin line, you know what I'm saying, of what's underneath in every Mexican community. Yeah. I mean, these conditions are the same everywhere, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what people need to be asking was, you know, or looking at was, is this past, specifically this past year of incidents that have happened in this community that's turning into very, you know, this type of situation where the people are starting to take on the police on their own, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and as always, you know, you know, there's always, when there's resistance happening, you know, the state tries to blame it on, you know, on the people. You know, when it's actually the state, its own actions that caused people to resist.
Definitely.
You know, and it's been an exciting thing just to watch the general mobilization of the of the Mexican community here in the U.S. and the response. Imperialism's response, which has been one of, you know, it's just like a real serious kind of fear, you know. You hear imperialist pundits, you know, who, you know, talk about this whole problem in terms of the border not holding up and you know, this fear that Mexican people are taking back their land and whatnot. And it's exciting to see. You know, to experience to see imperialism experiencing this crisis, you know, that is, you know, coming home, not just, you know, hitting them in the various places around the world, but also hitting them right here at home.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is, man. It's surprising. It was surprising, I think, to everyone to see how many people came out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And yeah, there was that question of, you know. Right now it's a peaceful demonstration, but what's going to happen if we piss them off a little bit more, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, that scared a lot of people, man. That scared a lot of white people, I should say. Yeah. A lot of white people, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, this stuff with these Minutemen, that's something real serious there. I mean, and, you know, I mean, you it's like you look at organizations, these white left organizations who, you know, talk about all the workers of the world unite and whatnot, but you see white workers, you know, coming out there and you know, acting as Minutemen, you know, trying to prevent, you know, Mexican people coming back on their own land. It's a ridiculous type of thing, you know, that
right.
That shows the colonial question, you know, being the primary question, the fact that, you know, there's a general white unity with the white imperialist state that would steal the resources of the rest of the world.
Right, definitely. I mean, yeah, this is the white workers here who are uniting with U.S. imperialism, uniting with colonialism, upholding their colonial past. You know what I'm saying? And you know, it's savage white people are joining, you know, young and old. You know what I'm saying? There's old ass white people out there who are, you know, happy about starving Mexicans out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and but you know, but even further than that, I mean, there's been a particular organization that a white left group that has come out in L.A. in particular. You know, that's a white left group, man. They're called the International Socialist Organization, and the ISO. And, you know, they come in, you know, to the demonstration that we got going on, and they basically try to divide it, you know. They call their own thing, you know, they do their own thing, try to supposedly take on the Minutemen, whatever, you know what I'm saying? But even these white people won't even unite with the fact that this is Mexican land and, you know, this is occupied land, you know. They won't even deal with that question. They, you know, talk about, you know, it's everybody's land and whatnot. So even ideologically, man, they're on, more united with the Minutemen than they are with us, you know what I'm saying? So,
right.
You know, they claim to be, you know, some type of saviors for our community, you know what I'm saying?
And that's the type of relationship, you know, the white left likes to enjoy with our community, you know, one where they can, you know, have this supposed unity with our community, but it has to be one that's on their own terms, you know what I'm saying, as opposed to uniting with colonized peoples, you know, on our own terms, you know, when it's our damn struggle that we're making, you know, they want to be able to determine, you know, how we struggle. You know, you have to struggle peacefully, you know, or whatnot. You know, it's because they want to protect. They are trying to solve the crisis of imperialism as opposed to, you know, us who have to struggle to deepen this crisis, you know, in order to solve our own, you know, contradiction that, you know, imperialism lives at our expense.
Right, exactly, yeah, right.
Well, I wanna take another break real quick, comrade, and come back and have some more discussion about, you know, just what's going on in Mexico, both sides of the illegitimate border. So we'll be right back with more Africa Live on AhuaRadio.com.
Rally round the black, rally round the red, gold, black and green.
shop, donate, and volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles for great deals on high-quality used furniture and unique treasures. Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles is a non-profit used furniture and collectible store with outlets in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Oakland, California, and St. Petersburg, Florida. Uhuru Furniture Stores are an institution of the African People's Education and Defense Fund for genuine economic development for the African community. All donations are tax deductible. Volunteer at Uhuru Furniture and Collectibles to be part of a great community of people who have a true desire to change the conditions of life for the African community. To locate the store nearest you, visit apedf.org and click the Uhuru Furniture link. That's APEDF, the acronym for African People's Education and Defense Fund. Or simply Google Uhuru Furniture. Welcome back to Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've been talking with Comrade Ricardo Favela from Mexicanos Unidos en Defensa del Pueblo, MUDP, Mexican National Liberation Organization, that and we've been talking about, you know, the resistance and organization that's going on within the Mexican community on both sides of the illegitimate border. Uhuru, comrade.
Uhuru.
So, sorry, throat getting a little dry. You were telling us about some of the campaigns that your organization MUDP has been taking on. Could you speak more? We talked briefly during the break. You were saying that you guys had ran somebody for city council there.
Yes, we did. This was a response to, you know, again, what the Minutemen began to have free access into our community and to do what they do, you know what I'm saying? And as a matter of fact, they pushed the city council in Vista to implement an ordinance which was supposed to regulate the hiring of day laborers and whatnot. And if anything, more than anything, was supposed to deter people from hiring day laborers, and it was their way of dealing with this problem that they saw as a problem. Because legally, I mean, by law, they had the right, the day laborers have the right to be there to look for work. That it's just, you know, it's part of a constitutional right, and it's a human right, you know what I'm saying? From pressure of these Minutemen, like I said, most of them don't even live in the community. I think it's like one or two that actually live in Vista. The city council listened to, 20 white people as opposed to the 2,000 Mexican people that took a stance on May 1st just recently. You know what I'm saying? So, we could say that how white power works, was working in this community. We felt that it would be, in order to give continuity to the struggle and to deal with that question, we figured it would be good to run someone for city council, someone who was willing to do that. And this was done through the coalition, which is mainly a mass coalition, at best, a progressive coalition that was formed. A compañera by the name of Tina Jillings stepped forward, and she came out. She was drawn to the coalition, after when it was formed after the shootings, her position. She came in as an individual, and her position. She joined the human rights work. She joined the human rights committee, and so that was basically the platform of her campaign, another way of dealing with the city officials, the city council in this campaign. We actually had someone there that was able to contest the other four or five people that were running and call them on their shit, you know what I'm saying, and put out a progressive position in defense of human rights. That was done fairly successfully. And this is a community that, in an area, all this area, North County, which has historically been very reactionary, at times very violent, towards the Mexican community. And there hasn't been, aside from some of the work that we've been doing, there hasn't really been any type of serious, consistent opposition, So this is basically, for the first time they're being challenged by someone. There wasn't someone that was, there that was trying to fight over who could attack the Mexican community more,
Yeah.
So it was just another a way of opening up the struggle. She actually through this process, she learned to be, she learned about her own leadership potential, because this is someone that, again, she has a high school diploma as far as her education, she's like the people, So, and the people have this sense of, that people in political office are deserving of this, of their positions, that they have something about them that, places them above everyone else. But it allowed for her and the rest of us to see, these people, when they're dealt with, on these terms, anybody can take them on,
Yeah.
That's what's interesting about that. So there was a lot that was learned from this campaign and whatnot. Towards the end of the campaign, when I guess there was a real fear, maybe, I don't know, from the Minutemen in particular, that she might actually had the potential to win a position, because of what she was talking about. She was gaining a lot of support,
yeah,
and whatnot. The Minutemen themselves began to attack her, through the newspaper, tried to slander her, and whatnot. And it got to the point where they had, you know, because the Minutemen, when they go out to the day labor sites, they take their video cameras and all that. And there was an instance a few months ago where Tina, you know, was, you know, basically, you know, or one of the Minutemen put a camera up in her face, and she was just, like, you know, trying to block the view and whatnot. And they tried to put it online saying that she was being aggressive and attacking the Minutemen and whatever, you know what I'm saying? So they put it on YouTube.com, and this was, like, maybe about 3 or 4 days before their election. It was their way, you know, it was their desperate attempt to try to isolate her and slander her, and it wasn't very effective. But so this video was put on YouTube.com, and no one really checked it out. It was like during the days of the election, one of her family members had noticed that someone was snooping around her home, and within those days, I guess their alarm went off. Someone was trying to enter her home. And I think it was a day or two after the election that some people had gone to her home, and they pretty much vandalized her vehicle. You know what I'm saying? They spray painted all these anti-Mexican slogans on their car. You know what I'm saying? Saying illegals go home. You're not an American.
Yeah.
You know, they put a bitch on there, whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Huh.
So. So you know, basically, I mean, we took it as a serious attempt to do some type of harm to the compañera and her family.
You know what I'm saying?
You know, which you know only speaks to the fact of, you know, what type of people we're dealing with. I mean, these aren't, you know, in addition to that, the same website, the YouTube.com, which was put, you know, this video was put up there by the one Minuteman that lives in Vista. You know, his name is Mike Spencer. You know, some of the comments that people put on this website around the same time that someone was trying to get into her home was they were calling for her to be disappeared, and someone even called for her to be killed and beat up. And this was happening at the same time that someone was trying to enter her home. So, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I mean, we know what type of people we're dealing with, these white nationalists. Even though they give this appearance that there's some type of new, civilian group or whatnot, I mean, it's the same elements that comprise the neo-Nazi groups, you know, historically. I mean, you know, and even white nationalism, even patriotism is a very reactionary, you know what I'm saying, colonial expression, you know what I'm saying, which in itself that...
Because
terrible, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it you know, you're talking about your organization's participation in the electoral process there, and it reminds me of the participation of the Uhuru movement in the electoral process in St. Petersburg, Florida. Recently, I think maybe a year or two ago, we ran Chimurenga Waller for city council, and just like in the campaign that you guys took on, I mean you had this ability to use this campaign to organize the masses of people organize the masses of people, not in opposition just to this candidate that they're running against, you know, or the group of candidates that they're running against, but also against the entire imperialist apparatus, you know, which, you know, you can't overstate the significance of such a process when taken on in a way that recognizing the limitations of the electoral process, but also the possibilities in terms of opening the eyes of the community. And at the end of that electoral process, also you had this real serious attack being made by the imperialist media, by other forces in the white community, you know, where, like, here, I mean, they ran like 10 articles in the matter of a week or so against Chimurenga Waller, you know, and just trying to mobilize, you know, this opposition, you know, to him getting into office. And while he didn't win the election, we won a lot more in terms of the understanding in this community, deepening the understanding of the African community here of you know, the issues that we're dealing with in this community, and African people are dealing with in general, you know. And you know, I think that's an important process. And but it also shows, you know, how the state would react, how the state reacts to this thing, you know, to the possibility of to this opposition, to, you know, the possibility of it being exposed, you know. And so are there any other how successful was that campaign in terms of like the numbers and stuff?
Well, she did win over 10% of the vote.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we felt, I mean, for this being our first time, even for all of us participating in something like this, we felt it was pretty significant.
Yeah.
You know, which in Vista means it was over 3,000 votes.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? What's also interesting was that in the mayor aspect, there was the last mayor, which was, this guy's a pretty timid white guy, you know what I'm saying? I mean, he's not as so rabid about attacking the Mexican community. I mean, even though, you know, he did support this ordinance, you know what I'm saying, compared to the Minutemen, he's somewhat tame, you know. So the Minutemen had ran this guy was running that was backed by the Minutemen by the name of Mantor. And Tina, I think, received more votes than this guy did. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he lost pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I think Tina received, you know, as much, she received as much, or if not more, than this guy was able to do.
Yeah.
And one of the other city council members who was also backed by the Minutemen, he didn't win, you know what I'm saying? He actually had less votes this year than he did last year.
Yeah.
Or the last election. So I mean, so it's interesting as far as that in the aspect of numbers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, the influence is much greater than the numbers, you know, that show in the polls. Because for one, a lot of colonized people are disenfranchised, you know, don't have the right to vote and whatnot.
Exactly. Especially, in Mexican community. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is, like for instance, here, in St. Petersburg, Florida, where we're broadcasting out of right now, when we ran Chimurenga Waller, the numbers in terms of votes wasn't very high, but the media, in attempts to undermine again, you know, the significance, undermine, you know, the significance of our movement, did a poll in the community. Of course, it was a real what do you call it? It was real skewed in terms of the way that they interviewed people and whatnot. But they did a poll in the area in the district that he ran for city council, and still, you know, overwhelming number of people. It was a majority of Africans in the community said that the Uhuru movement either always or most of the time represented their views, you know. So, you know, I mean, they even in their attempting to organize against us, you know, they shoot themselves in the foot, and they show the significance of the resistance, you know.
Yeah.
So, what other campaigns are you guys involved in?
Well, in terms of the other campaign, we just wrapped up, you know, a meeting yesterday, which we met with, you know, forces from around the state of California and some groups from Mexico, from along, you know, the northern side of Mexico, which is known as in the state of Baja California. Some indigenous representatives of some of the indigenous communities participated in this meeting yesterday. And struggles are going to be coming out in the near future. in relation to the indigenous peoples of these communities. And if some people know, Tijuana in Mexico, Tijuana is the city immediately along the other side of the illegitimate border, south of San Diego. And then next to Tijuana, there's Rosarito, and then Ensenada, right? Some of these indigenous people came from Ensenada and whatnot. So it's not very far in terms of where we're based at.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the people that came there from the Kumeyaay Nation was known as the Kumeyaay Nation. The Kumeyaay Nation, they historically, the lands of San Diego, from San Diego down to Ensenada, have been their land. It's their lands. I mean, that's basically where the people are from, which means that this border literally divided, their own nation of their own indigenous tribe, what they call a tribe. So you have a nation of Kumeyaay in Mexico, and you have a nation of Kumeyaay over here. And the Kumeyaay over here, they're one of the tribes that have a casino and whatnot. But that's some of the background of the Kumeyaay people, who are living in Mexico. I mean, still living, in marginalization and extreme poverty and whatnot. The Kumeyaay and the Kukapa, that was the other representative. That was the Kukapa nation. They subsist off of the fishing in the area. They've always, that's just been their way of life, is living off of the sea and the fish from the sea. Just recently, as part of the neoliberal trade policies and whatnot, an ecological group has gone into this area of Ensenada and has declared a certain area where they fish as an ecological reserve, which basically is barring them from, access to the ocean, and fishing. But at the same time, they're granting, fishing licenses to people who can afford to pay them, which is basically, tourists and white people.
Yeah.
And they go out there with their boats and, do their thing out there. So as part of when La Otra Campaña passed through their community, one of the proposals, one of the resolutions was to create an encampment, on the ocean front and whatnot in this community and fish. They're going to go out there and they're going to fish. They're basically going to, go out there and fish and create a struggle from that to see how the state right there, the government responds and the ecological reserves and just struggle for the right to fish there,
Yeah.
And for us, I mean, it seems somewhat simple, but, let me just remind you guys, I mean, this is the same strategy that was taken in Atenco.
Yeah.
Where people just, they weren't allowed to sell flowers. Well, they went out and they sold flowers and it turned into this major, resistance, type of rebellion,
Yeah.
And this is what's interesting, that, the other campaign is characterizing itself right now as a nonviolent movement, but that's a strategy for getting people behind, some type of struggle, Because the fact of the matter is, the liberation armies are there, they're in place. The guerrilla movements, they're there,
Yeah.
The struggle needs to be opened up on different fronts, where, not everybody right now is ready to go and join an armed movement, But we know that there's a process involved, in terms of struggling, and the EZLN even talks about redefining the concept of a national liberation army.
Hmm.
So the EZLN are putting out some very interesting, ideas out there that, again, that I recommend that you guys check out the sixth declaration of the Lacandonan Jungle, which you can find off the EZLN webpage. But, they're talking about redefining, you know, creating a new type of politics and redefining, you know, trying to redefine the concept of a national liberation army. You know what I'm saying? So the right now, at this point, you know, it's characterizing itself as a nonviolent movement. But what they're saying is, you know, the state is going to, depending on how the state responds to this, you know what I'm saying? You know, they, you know, the state can, you know, whatever, try to deal with this, you know, in a humane way, you know, but we know they won't, you know what I'm saying? So basically we know it's only going to, you know, this type of movement will only deepen, you know what I'm saying, and push more people to struggle. So that's the potential of this type of national plan of struggle that's being implemented at this point. And that's going to happen in February of this coming year, late February. And, you know, we're going to be opening up, you know, support centers where we're going to make a call for food and water and other type of, you know, any type of medical supplies, anything that we can help, you know, we're going to transport to these communities so that way they can, you know, the people that are going to dedicate themselves to this encampment for 3 months won't have to worry about food or water and whatnot. They can deal with the struggle and all that. So we're going to open up support centers around here for that. And the other question that's going to happen on October 12th of next year is that there's going to be a continental conference, continental meeting of indigenous peoples, and it's going to happen in the same community in Ensenada, you know. And then they're choosing now the northern part of Mexico because for the most part, the question of indigenous people in Mexico has dealt with the people living in central Mexico and living in southern Mexico. I mean, everybody knows about the Zapatistas and the people of Chiapas and, you know, now Oaxaca and all that. But, you know, it's basically, you know, the way, you know, the people in northern Mexico, the indigenous peoples are looking for an avenue to join this national indigenous movement, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And also, you know, there's, again, it's going to open up to a conference of working with indigenous peoples across the continent.
Right on. So
that's coming out in October 12th of next year.
Right on. Yeah. I want to let folks know out there who are listening again that you can participate in this discussion that we're having. If you're located in the U.S., you can call toll-free at 1-877-824-3337. That's 1-877-824-3337. That's toll-free number in the U.S. Or if you're outside of the U.S., you can call. It's not toll-free, but you can call by dialing country code 001-727-824-5700. Again, that's country code 001-727-824-5700 to call from outside of the U.S. And you can also participate by emailing us. You can click email DJ on the right side of your Uhuru Radio website. Or you can email us directly at dj@uhururadio.com. We have a question in from email from an SD in Florida who asked the question, what does Aztlan mean?
Okay. What Aztlan is a term in Nahuatl, which is one of the major indigenous languages, probably the most broadly spoken indigenous language of Mexican peoples, people from Mexico, even what's North America, you know, Nahuatl, you know. I mean, you know, we had names for our lands before the colonizer came, you know. Mexico was originally known, it was known as the certain region where Mexico City was Mexicat, and the general country of Mexico was known as Anahuac. And Aztlan was referred to as the area that was north, a little bit more north of Mexico, which is, you know, the areas right now, Arizona, Colorado, you know what I'm saying, Texas, you know, whatnot. It was generally just referring to the north of Mexico. And according to the descendants of Mexican people, which are known as the Mexica people. We originated from Aztlan. Aztlan was a place of origin for our peoples. You know what I'm saying? And this is a people related to the Navajo peoples, the Hopi, the Anasazi, and whatnot. There's quite a few nations that came out of this area of the Southwest, what's known as the Southwestern United States, that through the times have migrated different areas of these lands, as a matter of fact, to talk about the Nahuatl is very reflective of the reach of a people's culture and whatnot. Seattle, Washington, which is by Oregon and whatnot, Seattle itself is a Nahuatl word. You know what I'm saying? So some people think that Mexican people have always been where present-day, Mexico is. I mean, this border, this illegitimate border, kind of makes us think that, well, that's where Mexicans have always been. That's where they're always going to be. You know what I'm saying? But even like I was saying, Chief Seattle from Washington is a Nahuatl word. The Nahuatl language reached even that far up. You know what I'm saying? So our culture has been here for thousands of years across these lands, and it's basically what we refer to as the Southwestern United States, lands that were taken by an invasion in 1848. You know, a similar invasion as to what's happening right now in Iraq, where the U.S. government provoked a confrontation with the Mexican government and invaded, killed. Many people, committed a genocide basically to remove Mexican people from these lands and to remove indigenous people from these lands and is basically the occupied southwestern part of the United States. And that's what we refer to as Aztlan.
Yeah. Okay. And, comrade, we have another question in, another email in. This person, this is from Sandra, who says, great to hear about the work of the Mexican comrades. I have a couple of questions. Is your organization comprised primarily of Spanish-speaking Mexican people, or does your organization include members or have fraternal relations with the indigenous people considered American Indian, like AIM or other groups?
Our organization is comprised mainly of Mexican people, bilingual, Spanish and English speaking. We've attempted to work with other groups in the local area. We've gotten in contact with AIM, but there's not a strong AIM presence out here. You know what I'm saying? I think in Los Angeles there might be something, but we've been able to work mainly with indigenous peoples from Mexico within the organization. What's interesting is the fact that there's this contradiction that exists, between Mexican people and what people call the Native Americans, indigenous peoples from these areas. Whereas they, due to the school, the colonial schools or whatnot, many of the indigenous people see us as the same way that white people see us, as foreigners, as whatnot. You know, say it's somewhat ridiculous. We've been doing events every October 12th to kind of open us up to the indigenous people, to talk about the fact that we're a colonized people and whatnot, and kind of break through this colonial mindset. You know what I'm saying? And it's turned into, unfortunately, it's turned into almost like a gang type of thing, where the Native American youth, and where we live in Fallbrook, just east of here, just half an hour east of here, there's something like 5 reservations out here. You know what I'm saying? Just in this particular area. And some of the people that live there, some of the nations, one of the nations is comprised of the Kumeyaay, like I was talking about, the Kumeyaay Nation. Which extends all the way down to Mexico. But there is this, sadly, there is this contradiction that, that exists and hasn't really, worked to our, to the point where we've been able to work together as we should be working together. But that's just this area.
within the Mexican liberation movement, historically, there has been certain instances where a Native American people aim, and a particular organization called the Crusade for Justice have worked in very tight solidarity. I don't know if some people will recall the occupation of Wounded Knee, where in the 70s, in which indigenous peoples were reclaiming lands in I think it was North or South Dakota, and the Mexican the Chicano liberation or movement was very central in providing a lifeline to these comrades that were taking back their lands, in terms of exposing this in the media, in terms of providing supplies for them, saying, even to the point where the state came down on the Crusade for Justice and bombed their headquarters due to the their support of the occupation of Wounded Knee. And in that sense, even I believe one person in particular was killed. One Crusade member was killed as a consequence of this attack from the state. So there's in that aspect there has been a very united efforts. Working together, specifically that's more in Colorado. And those type of instances that have occurred throughout our history of struggle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This listener also has another question. It says, are the traditionally Mexican neighborhoods experiencing gentrification, displacement, and land grabbing by white land speculators in California?
Definitely. Yeah, that's happening. That's happening. In San Diego, a whole community was destroyed to build a new baseball park for the San Diego Padres.
Huh.
It's known as Petco Park, but a Mexican community that's been there for longest time was kicked out. Condominiums were built in their place. To the point that were so expensive to the point where the people can't even afford to live there. Definitely, gentrification is a problem. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We have 10 minutes left, comrade. I wanted to ask you, because we've been talking about the stuff in Oaxaca, Atenco, and the whole other campaign. And it seems like the election process there in Mexico has just sparked off just a lot of stuff. And one of the things that that we've seen is also this thing with one of the presidential candidates, López Obrador. And I wanted you to, if you can speak to that, in terms of who Obrador is and just what's the situation with that whole question.
Okay. That's definitely interesting. What's happened is Obrador is a member of the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution. The PRD is a party that broke off of the PRI, the Party of the Institutional Revolution, which has been the party that has been ruling, was ruling Mexico for the past 70 years, and notorious for its corruption and whatnot, and its ties to U.S. imperialism. The PRD broke off as some type of opposition to that. In 1988, and this goes back, to 1988 as well, the presidential candidate for the PRD by the name of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas ran for president of Mexico. A similar situation happened where there was an electoral fraud. Many people were convinced that he won the election, and the election was robbed from him,
Yeah.
And unlike unlike the response of people over here to an election fraud, the people were saying, you know, let's take the government. You know, workers were saying, you know, we'll get armed, we'll back you, to hell with this shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the PRD themselves said, you know what, nah. You know what I'm saying? They just basically conceded to it. They decided not to struggle, and basically let the people down. You know what I'm saying? And it was a large fallout from their party. You know, but for the most part, what the PRD has proven to be is just another party that's been uniting with the ruling class. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
They're somewhat more progressive than the other two major parties. But, I mean, when it comes down to it, they align with the ruling class. You know what I'm saying? Historically, that's what they've been doing. So this time around, you had someone by the name of López Obrador, who was also a member of this party, and... some people would say he's just a little left of center. You know what I'm saying? He's a populist. You know what I'm saying? What people are, the media is trying to pass him off as some type of leftist. You know, some type of alternative to Mexican people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But you know, knowing the history of the PRD and whatnot, you know, even the PRD historically have. Turn their backs on the Zapatista movement. You know what I'm saying? I mean, always when it comes down to it, they align themselves with imperialism. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
López Obrador is probably one of the more honest forces within the PRD that have been there recently. He's a populist. You know, he became popular as being a mayor of Mexico City. When he basically pushed for the creation of a direct route, a highway that would lead to a hospital, you know, and some of the other oppositional parties weren't in favor of this, for their own selfish interests.
Right.
And because this guy actually took some type of stance against the other parties, he quickly was embraced by working people. You know what I'm saying? That they actually found someone that was willing to take some type of stance against them, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Which speaks, you know, of the conditions in Mexico, that the people are looking for some type of alternative, you know what I'm saying? Even if it's just this one guy taking this one stance, I mean, it's something, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So this guy, because of that, the ruling parties, the PRI and what's known as the PAN, the PAN, which is a more, ultra-conservative, group in Mexico that is very closely tied with U.S. imperialism. They began to attack Obrador. They began to slander him during the elections. They tried to disqualify him. You know what I'm saying? So the more he got attacked, the more the people were lining up with him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it came down to the point where, you know, this election happened. There was... much evidence of the fact that there was a fraud, that ballots were stuffed, you know what I'm saying? In certain areas, there weren't enough ballots for people to vote, you know what I'm saying? They've attempted to pull off an electoral fraud, you know what I'm saying? Impose a president upon the Mexican people, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And seeing that in 1988, the same thing happened in 88, Obrador said, you know what, we got to do something, basically. He's been out there creating some type of opposition, you know, which it has its limitations. I mean, the people are behind him, again, because, like I said, because somebody's taking some type of stance, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
But
yeah.
The thing with the PRD is that they won't go beyond denouncing the election. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's all they talk about. In a certain aspect, these elections have redeemed their party. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because they're actually now doing something about it, and you know, but Obrador, like in the final analysis, he's a populist. He's maybe a little left of center. He's no Hugo Chavez.
Right.
What I'm saying? Nowhere near being a Hugo Chavez and whatnot. But yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of people have been following him, and I was going to mention something else. I forgot. But
we got 3 minutes left, comrade. So I want to, if you can, I want to one for people who would like to get involved with your organization and the work that you're doing. Want to get involved with MUDP. And the work on the ground there. How could they get in contact with you guys? And also, go ahead and hit me with that.
you can reach us either by email. You can reach us at MUDP Mensajero, MUDP MENSAJERO. At yahoo.com. You can call 760-468-4519. Those are two ways to reach us. I don't know if you want me to give you a mailing address.
What we can do is we can put your information up on the website so they can get it from there.
So, as a matter of fact, we have a website. That might be the better way.
Ah, there you go.
We have a website, which is mudp.org.
Okay. Okay. All right. So we have about a minute left, comrade. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Oh yeah. What I wanted to say, just to wrap up with Obrador, was the fact that they don't go beyond denouncing the elections. You know what I'm saying? They won't go. When the problem is the damn system. You know what I'm saying? If they're really going to provide some type of alternative, they need to start denouncing the whole damn system, which they won't. They won't do. And they're trying to fix the capitalist system and shit, But, what is coming down to in Mexico, this is the crisis is getting so profound that different forces are lining up,
Yeah.
Forces are lining up for power. So we think we're honestly, in the final offensive in Mexico in terms of taking down the capitalist system, and this has profound ramifications for Mexican people on this side of the border. So that's what we're looking at, man.
Okay.
And just wanted to say that we stand in solidarity with the Uhuru movement. We understand that a liberated Africa, is going to benefit colonized people everywhere. So we wholeheartedly support the efforts of the party, and we wish them, we offer our fullest solidarity.
Right on. And it's a two-way relationship.